April 22, 2013. The first quarter of 2013 was fairly spectacular for the US, up 11%, Switzerland up 10%, and Japan up 9%, and some smaller markets like Sweden, Mexico, and Turkey. Unfortunately for Canada, the SPTSX was down about 3% due to weakness in the materials and utilities sectors. However, since the end of March, markets have become a lot more volatile. Although the US was flat, Canada has dropped 6% as of April 17, 2013, due to weakness in gold and other resources. Europe is still trying to sort out its peripheral countries' ongoing sovereign debt crisis, mainly as to who should pay and how it should be paid. For now, there is no clear resolution. As an aside, most of these crises resolve themselves through time, involving some economic dislocation, default, and restructuring. Stay tuned! The recent decline in gold prices begs the question as to whether gold and other precious metals should be considered as investments. The following is an excerpt from Warren Buffett's 2011 annual letter to shareholders, where he discussed his thoughts regarding investing, a timeless explanation as to how an investor should think regarding this topic. For those of you who would like to read the original letter, highly recommended, you can go to Berkshire Hathaway's website. While you are there, if you are interested, we would recommend reading all the posted letters. The basic choices for investors, and the one we strongly prefer. Investing is often described as the process of laying out money now in the expectation of receiving more money in the future. At Berkshire, we take a more demanding approach, defining investing as the transfer to others of purchasing power now, with the reasoned expectation of receiving more purchasing power, after taxes have been paid on nominal gains, in the future. More succinctly, investing is foregoing consumption now in order to have the ability to consume more at a later date. From our definition, there flows an important corollary. The riskiness of an investment is not measured by beta, a Wall Street term encompassing volatility and often used in measuring risk, but rather by the probability, the reasoned probability, of that investment causing its owner a loss of purchasing power over his contemplating holding period. Assets can fluctuate greatly in price and not be risky, as long as they are reasonably certain to deliver increased purchasing power over their holding period. And as we will see, a non-fluctuating asset can be laden with risk. Investment possibilities are both many and varied. There are three major categories, however, and it's important to understand the characteristics of each. So let's survey the field. Investments that are denominated in a given currency include money market funds, bonds, mortgages, bank deposits, and other instruments. Most of these currency-based investments are thought of as safe. In truth, they are among the most dangerous of assets. Their beta may be zero, but their risk is huge. Over the past century, these instruments have destroyed the purchasing power of investors in many countries, even as the holders continued to receive timely payments of interest and principal. This ugly result, moreover, will forever recur. Governments determine the ultimate value of money, and systemic forces will sometimes cause them to gravitate to policies that produce inflation. From time to time, such policies spin out of control. Even in the US, where the wish for a stable currency is strong, the dollar has fallen a staggering 86% in value since 1965, when I took over management of Berkshire. It takes no less than $7 today to buy what $1 did at that time. Consequently, a tax-free institution would have needed 4.3% interest annually from bond investments over that period to simply maintain its purchasing power. Its managers would have been kidding themselves if they thought of any portion of that interest as income. For tax-paying investors like you and me, the picture has been far worse. During the same 47-year period, continuous rolling of U.S. Treasury bills produced 5.7% annually. That sounds satisfactory, but if an individual investor paid personal income taxes at a rate averaging 25%, this 5.7% return would have yielded nothing in the way of real income. This investor's visible income tax would have stripped him of 1.4 points of the stated yield, and the invisible inflation tax would have devoured the remaining 4.3 points. It's noteworthy that the implicit inflation tax was more than triple the explicit income tax that our investor probably thought of as his main burden. In God We Trust may be imprinted on our currency, but the hand that activates our government's printing press has been all too human. High interest rates, of course, can compensate purchasers for the inflation risk they face with currency-based investments. And indeed, rates in the early 1980s did that job nicely. Current rates, however, do not come close to offsetting the purchasing power risk that investors assume. Right now, bonds should come with a warning label. Under today's conditions, therefore, I do not like currency-based investments. Even so, Berkshire holds significant amounts of them, primarily of the short-term variety. At Berkshire, the need for ample liquidity occupies center stage and will never be slighted, however inadequate rates may be. Accommodating this need, we primarily hold U.S. Treasury bills, the only investment that can be counted on for liquidity under the most chaotic of economic conditions. Our working level for liquidity is $20 billion. $10 billion is our absolute minimum. Beyond the requirements that liquidity and regulators impose on us, we will purchase currency-related securities only if they offer the possibility of unusual gain, either because a particular credit is mispriced, as can occur in periodic junk bond debacles, or because rates rise to a level that offers the possibility of realizing substantial capital gains on high-grade bonds when rates fall. Though we've exploited both opportunities in the past, and may do so again, we are now 180 degrees removed from such prospects. Today, a wry comment that Wall Streeter Shelby Cullum Davis made long ago seems apt. Bonds promoted as offering risk-free returns are now priced to deliver return-free risk. The second major category of investments involves assets that will never produce anything, but that are purchased in the buyer's hope that someone else, who also knows that the assets will be forever unproductive, will pay more for them in the future. Tulips, of all things, briefly became a favorite of such buyers in the 17th century. This type of investment requires an expanding pool of buyers, who in turn are enticed because they believe the buying pool will expand still further. Owners are not inspired by what the asset itself can produce. It will remain lifeless forever, but rather by the belief that others will desire it even more avidly in the future. The major asset in this category is gold, currently a huge favorite of investors who fear almost all other assets, especially paper money, of whose value, as noted, they are right to be fearful. Gold, however, has two significant shortcomings, being neither of much use nor procreative. True, gold has some industrial and decorative utility. But the demand for these purposes is both limited and incapable of soaking up new production. Meanwhile, if you own 1 ounce of gold for an eternity, you will still own 1 ounce at its end. What motivates most gold purchasers is their belief that the ranks of the fearful will grow. During the past decade, that belief has proved correct. Beyond that, the rising price has on its own generated additional buying enthusiasm, attracting purchasers who see the rise as validating an investment thesis. As bandwagon investors join any party, they create their own truth, for a while. Over the past 15 years, both internet stocks and houses have demonstrated the extraordinary excesses that can be created by combining an initially sensible thesis with well-publicized rising prices. In these bubbles, an army of originally skeptical investors succumbed to the proof delivered by the market, and the pool of buyers, for a time, expanded sufficiently to keep the bandwagon rolling. But bubbles blown large enough inevitably pop, and then the old proverb is confirmed once again. What the wise man does in the beginning, the fool does in the end. Today the world's gold stock is about 170,000 metric tons. If all of this gold were melded together, it would form a cube of about 68 feet per side. Picture it fitting comfortably within a baseball infield. At $1,750 per ounce, gold's price as I write this, its value would be $9.6 trillion. Call this cube pile A. Let's now create a pile B costing an equal amount. For that, we could buy all U.S. cropland, 400 million acres, with output of about $200 billion annually, plus 16 ExxonMobils. The world's most profitable company, one earning more than $40 billion annually. After these purchases, we would have about $1 trillion left over for walking around money. No sense feeling strapped after this buying binge. Can you imagine an investor with $9.6 trillion selecting pile A over pile B? Beyond the staggering valuation given the existing stock of gold, current prices make today's annual production of gold come in about $160 billion. Buyers, whether jewelry and industrial users, frightened individuals, or speculators, must continually absorb this additional supply to merely maintain an equilibrium at present prices. A century from now, the 400 million acres of farmland will have produced staggering amounts of corn, wheat, cotton, and other crops, and will continue to produce that valuable bounty, whatever the currency may be. ExxonMobil will probably have delivered trillions of dollars in dividends to its owners, and will also hold assets worth many more trillions. And remember, you get 16 Exxons. The 170,000 tons of gold will be unchanged in size and still incapable of producing anything. You can fondle the cube, but it will not respond. Admittedly, when people a century from now are fearful, it's likely many will still rush to gold. I'm confident, however, that the $9.6 trillion current valuation of pile A will compound over the century at a rate far inferior to that achieved by pile B. Our first two categories enjoy maximum popularity at peaks of fear. Terror over economic collapse drives individuals to currency-based assets, most particularly U.S. obligations, and fear of currency collapse fosters movement to sterile assets such as gold. We heard cash is king in late 2008, just when cash should have been deployed rather than held. Similarly, we heard cash is trash in the early 1980s, just when fixed dollar investments were at their most attractive level in memory. On those occasions, investors who required a supportive crowd paid dearly for that comfort. My own preference, and you knew this was coming, is our third category, investment in productive assets, whether businesses, farms, or real estate. Ideally, these assets should have the ability in inflationary times to deliver output that will retain its purchasing power value while requiring a minimum of new capital investment. Farms, real estate, and many businesses such as Coca-Cola, IBM, and our own See's Candy meet that double-barreled test. Certain other companies, think of our regulated utilities for example, fail it because inflation places heavy capital requirements on them. To earn more, their owners must invest more. Even so, these investments will remain superior to non-productive or currency-based assets. Whether the currency a century from now is based on gold, seashells, shark teeth, or a piece of paper, As today, people will be willing to exchange a couple of minutes of their daily labor for a Coca-Cola or some See's peanut brittle. In the future, the U.S. population will move more goods, consume more food, and require more living space than it does now. People will forever exchange what they produce for what others produce. Our country's businesses will continue to efficiently deliver goods and services wanted by our citizens. Metaphorically, these commercial cows will live for centuries and give even greater quantities of milk to boot. Their value will be determined not by the medium of exchange, but rather by their capacity to deliver milk. Proceeds from the sale of the milk will compound for the owners of the cows, just as they did during the 20th century when the Dow increased from 66 to 11,497, and paid loads of dividends as well. Berkshire's goal will be to increase its ownership of first-class businesses. Our first choice will be to own them in their entirety. But we will also be owners by way of holding sizable amounts of marketable stocks. I believe that over any extended period of time, this category of investing will prove to be the runaway winner among the three we've examined. More important, it will be by far the safest. Many of you have asked us about our outlook for the stock markets. As you know by now, we do not select investments based on macro predictions. That said, we are not blind to the world around us and do have a few thoughts about the general state of the markets. Here they are. Here is an update of our long-term U.S. stock market chart. We have shown a version of this back in the third quarter of 2008 during the financial crisis. The red line represents the S&P 500, and the blue line could be considered its long-term trend line. In other words, over the last 85 years or so, the market tends to go up 6.1% annually. Simplistically, when the market is above the trend line, we can assume that your long-term return will be below the average of 6.1%, while when the market is below the trend line, it will be above 6.1%. As you can see, in 2008, it was far below the trend line. Since then, your return has also been far above the average of 6.1%. From where we sit today, investors should probably not expect returns that are too far from the average. However, relative to bonds, we do not think this to be a bad scenario. Inflation or deflation? There is a big debate regarding what will come next. The conventional wisdom is that if the government prints money, there will be inflation. Yet, if we look at the two historical cases that have similarities with the 2008 financial crisis, 1932 in the U.S., the Great Depression, and 1989 in Japan, still ongoing, the government also printed a ton of money, and yet, there was no inflation for a long period of time. In fact, deflation sets in 3 to 4 years after the peak of the crisis. Moreover, with all the printing around the world, inflation has been sporadic and tame. Can anyone imagine if there was no printing at all? Would not have deflation set in for good? The lack of jobs seems to have held back labor cost increases, which is a major component of inflation. Until businesses feel optimistic about the economy, the fairness of regulation and taxes, they will not create enough jobs to soak up the supply of labor. What is happening to the Canadian dollar? Regardless of its level, investors should not forget that